They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew.
Joining me today, I have Tyler Birding, all the way from California. Tyler, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
It's good to talk to you. You've always been a little concerned about the fact that HOAs, are, and especially condominiums, have had a problem with financing and funding, and help us understand this a little better today, right?
I'll try.
You sent me some information, and you started off with the balcony of an eight-year-old apartment building in California that collapsed.
Yeah. In June of 2015, there was an apartment building in Berkeley, California. There is an apartment building in Berkeley, California, that some exchange students from Ireland were on the balcony, and it collapsed underneath them, and six of those students were killed and seven of them badly injured. It was a fourth-story balcony. The reason it collapsed was because of rot that was hidden in the soffit of the balcony, which was not easily detected through a normal visual inspection. As a consequence of that, the city of Berkeley and the state of California, the legislature, introduced regulations to require multifamily buildings like apartments and condos to be inspected, not just visually, but where needed, to also look beneath the surface to detect the beginning of any condition like rot that might endanger the structural stability of the balcony. That legislation is now winding its way through the California legislature.
It's just a visual inspection, or it's an inspection?
Yeah.
At what point?
The problem with it is that a visual inspection will not detect rot and other damage like corrosion and things like that that are occurring below the surface of the building, beneath the siding, under the roof coverings, within the foundation, things like that. And most community associations are required only to conduct inspections which are visual in nature and not required to probe beneath the surface of the building. So one of the lessons that I was hoping the condominium industry would learn was that you can't rely on such things as reserve studies that are based on visual inspections only, as the statute requires in California and other states, but that they should probe beneath the surface in a random number of these components so that they can determine if there's water getting in that might be causing a deterioration of the structural components for safety reasons. But it would also have done something else, and that is, it would have allowed the board of directors, the owners of the buildings, to detect damage at an early stage when it was relatively cheap to fix it, instead of waiting until either, of course, catastrophe occurs, or they discover it late in the project's life when it gets very, very expensive to repair these things. We're talking about $600 to caulk a joint that may be letting water in versus $15,000 to replace the balcony many years later. That's the kind of that's what this legislation would have encouraged or allowed boards to do, and is to not just avoid injuries and death, but also to detect deterioration early on while it's inexpensive to fix it. Unfortunately, some of the community association trade groups decided that they were opposed to this idea.
Why?
And they lobbied the legislature through their owners calling their individual legislators, and they were able to convince the author of the bill to drop community associations, condos, from the coverage of the bill, leaving only apartments to be inspected with a safety inspection. And that is kind of the background to the topic that I sent to you that made me focus on why would that be in the interest of the owners of these buildings not to know when they have an issue, a problem like that, in time to be able to fix it inexpensively.
What's the rationale behind that, Tyler? I just don't get it.
Well, and nor do I, but I understand why. Because the inspections themselves would not have been inexpensive, although they were required to only inspect 15% of these components every 6 years. So if you had 100 balconies, you only had to look at 15 of them every 6 years to comply with the legislation. But the inspections would be, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 every 6 years, or depending on how many balconies or walkways or any elevated structure like that that had to be inspected. So the cost of the inspection was one reason that was argued was too expensive for the owners to do. And then the cost of repairing these conditions when they're discovered can often be many, many thousands of dollars. And if they were discovered, the owners of the building, either the apartment owner or the condo owners, would be required to do a repair within a certain period of time. And they, I'm sure, were concerned that this would be extraordinarily expensive for them if they found that kind of damage in the building. It still doesn't make a lot of sense, because why wouldn't you want to know what costs were associated with repairing that kind of damage, both for safety reasons and in order to predict your budget going forward? I mean, if you have those kind of expenses, you want to be able to know that. Knowledge is power, right? So if you know that, you can budget for it over time and make repairs as needed. But the cost of it would have been translated into, very simply, higher assessments on individual owners and people who live in these projects now, put a tremendous amount of political pressure on their legislators and their boards of directors to keep assessments low. And that is the critical issue in this whole debate. It is keeping assessments low. And I appreciate that homeowners who live in these communities, some live on fixed incomes, some are, the assessments are a major part of their monthly expense, and they don't want to see them raised any higher than they have to be. But ignoring this kind of a problem in order to save the present owner's money conflicts with the long-term obligation of the corporate association to sustain that building. And therein is the issue that I've raised in the materials that I sent to you, and that is this conflict between the short-term interests of the present owners with the long-term obligations of the corporate association to sustain that that project, not just for the present owners, but for all the owners to come in the future. And if you ignore a problem now, and it's the kind of problem that's going to grow with time and grow more expensive, then the individuals that will suffer from that decision are not the present owners, but the owners who will come later who have to pay for the costly repairs when that damage is finally discovered, maybe 10, 15 years later. And we've seen lots of examples of that. So what's happened is that by doing this, by ignoring the problem, or by refusing to raise assessments on a regular basis, we're basically passing on present owner liability to future owners. And the present owners who then sell or move on are able to escape the cost, the true cost of owning that property. And they pass it on, they pass this liability on, kick the can down the road to owners who will come later.
You know, if I were unfortunate enough to be in one of those things, I think I would want to make sure that if I stepped out onto my balcony, I was not going to go down the fast way, or that if any of my friends or loved ones were on that balcony, that it was safe and secure for them to be on there. I think that's something that would be something I would want to know.
You a rational person would. But this fear of assessment increases drives most of the political decisions made by boards of directors. Keeping assessments, and I'll call it artificially low, meaning they aren't calculated to meet the true needs of the association, satisfies the political demand of the present owners, but ignores the needs, the long-term needs of the corporation, and their obligations to future owners who will be the ones to have to bear the cost of this when it's finally discovered and has to be repaired many years later when the cost is far greater.
You know, something else occurs to me, Tyler, and that's that the materials, the construction materials, are very inferior in this country. It's, you know, I jokingly, and it's not really much of a joke, and it's certainly no laughing matter, call it housing that's built out of cardboard and scotch tape.
Well,
you know, shouldn't...
Yeah, but that's a given. Let's assume that's true. And we do a lot of construction quality control work here, meaning we litigate bad construction. That's one of our firm's main lines here. So we see a lot of failed construction, and a lot of it has to do with materials, but an awful lot of it also has to do with workmanship issues. But let's take that as a given. Let's assume, and it's not always true. There's good buildings and bad buildings, but let's assume it's not a good building. Let's assume there's a problem that's letting water or moisture get inside under the skin of the building, behind the siding, within the... in the structural areas of the building, not like all at once, but gradually, bit by bit over time, so that it's gradually causing rot to the interior structural elements of the building. Why wouldn't a competent and responsible board of directors want to know that?
I would.
They want to know that when they can fix it at a relatively inexpensive price, rather than letting it go on for years and years when it will ultimately cost a lot of money, huge sums of money, to replace those rotted components. Here's the reason why. Number one, they don't know about it because they're not inspecting it for it. They are using visual inspections to determine what components are wearing out, and you can't see a lot of this stuff, or most of it, with visual-only inspections. Number two, the cost of intrusive inspections, where you would look into these areas and understand if there's water getting in, is expensive. And again, boards want to keep the cost of maintenance down as low as possible, so as the homeowners assessment, so the homeowners assessments won't go up. And let's not forget, board members are owners too, and they are political because they're elected by the membership. So their tendency is to do what the membership is asking them to do, both because they are elected by them and also because they're owners themselves and pay assessments. So the natural tendency is to say, well, we don't want to raise these assessments any more than we absolutely have to. And I understand that. But they don't know what their obligation should be to assess the members if they haven't looked and understand the true condition of the building. And most do not. And this damage stays hidden for years and years and years, and eventually shows up as a rotten balcony that could cause somebody some injury, and there's been numbers of cases where that's happened. Or it could just simply get to the point where obviously it has to be repaired, and by that time, just simply caulking a leaky joint isn't going to do it. You have to replace the entire structure at many tens of thousands of dollars. So we have a conflict in between the short-term interests of the ownership, the present ownership, and the long-term obligations of the corporate association, which is there forever. It's as long as that project's there, that association has to manage it. But owners move out, they sell, they move on. Average turnover is 5 to 7 years. Board members are only there for their elected term, you know, some maybe multiple terms, but still there's a limit to their involvement. So their interests are largely short-term, and they derive their obligations from the interests of the present owners. But the association itself, the corporation, has a very long-term interest, almost indefinite as long as that project exists, and has to plan for the future when other owners will be there and will have to bear the cost of repairing these things when and if this kind of damage is discovered down the road. Instead of doing inspections now, understanding where some of these problems lie and dealing with them while it's relatively inexpensive to do it, albeit with some increase in regular assessments, but nothing like what owners will face 10, 15 years down the road when this, if this damage is allowed to continue.
Who's the seminar that you're, who's going to be at the seminar that you're going to be delivering or presenting this to?
Property managers and board members of numerous associations in Northern California.
Tyler, it seems to me, I mean, there seems to be a disconnect all along the way. You've got all these various interests, and somehow the interests of the owners and the whole project is kind of falling apart because all these different interests are, I don't want to say fighting each other, but they're very different.
Well, there's a natural conflict going on, and it's part of the problem with the whole business model of community associations. We allow people to voluntarily decide what the level of assessments to the owners should be. When I say voluntary, I mean it's set by the board of directors as they see fit. Now there are statutes in California, the statutes require that a board assess their members as necessary to carry out the obligations of the association. But there's no supervision or oversight of that by the state or the county or anyone else. So it's pretty much a voluntary thing. It's like saying to you, well, how much income tax would you like to pay this year? You pay whatever you'd like. You know, you can imagine what would happen to the national budget. Board members try. They base their decisions on the advice of accountants and lawyers and reserve study professionals and others. So I'm not saying they are necessarily not doing their due diligence. They do it as they think they need to, or they do it as they are aware of what their obligations are. My point is they are not aware of what some of their obligations are, or if they are, they're often adversely influenced by the political demands of the present owners at the expense of those owners who will come later.
I think it makes perfectly good sense. Most people are not going to want to put money in for something, pay for something that they're really not going to get the benefit of, although they're getting the benefit of the newer building, and they're putting in the use. But I know it's just a real mess. Tyler, I've got so many thoughts here, and I'm not sure where to start. You're talking about your seminar goers being board members. I think this is something that regular homeowners and housing consumers, people who are not homeowners yet, but people who are likely to buy into a condo or a high-rise somehow, because they need to know that. That's something that they don't get at disclosure. You know, and there's just so much stuff that's piled on them.
It's often not disclosed because it's unknown. There's two funding obligations that I believe every association has. One is to fund the known expenses that are annual expenses that occur, and those are just things like management and insurance and water and all of the operational expenses that they incur. And in addition to that, their obligation is to put aside a certain amount of money every year in reserve for those to repair those components that they know are wearing out, like the roof or the paint, things like that, or the asphalt in the streets, things that they have to maintain. They know those things have a limited service life because professionals tell them they do, and they give them an assessment of how long it takes, how long until they have to repair it, and they then plan by putting money into a reserve account to pay for those things. But two things are happening. One is they are given these projections, but they often do not put enough aside in reserves to pay for them. And because they are trying to keep assessments low and are not raising assessments often, even to keep up with inflation, they begin to, and what gets deprived if they don't put enough money in annually to cover the needs of the association? What gets deprived is not the insurance coverage, not the management fees, not the water bill, because those all have to be paid in order to keep it going. What gets borrowed from or taken from is a reserve account. So they spend the reserves on operational costs, leaving the reserves underfunded. We just finished, along with a big accounting firm here in Northern California, a study which has been done every 3 or 4 years for almost 20 years now, on the level of funding of the reserves of the typical community association in Northern California. And what's happened is, over the last 20 years, reserve funding has gone from 62% of what is required to meet their known obligations, to now it's down to 51% of what they need to have in their accounts to fund their known future reserve obligations. So we're gradually depriving our reserve accounts more and more in order to meet the operational expenses, and we're not raising assessments enough to fully fund the reserve accounts. Now, keep in mind, the reserve accounts that are set up are for those problems that they know about. So the roof has got a 25-year life. They know they're going to have to fix it in 25 years. They only have half the money they should have right now in order to deal with that in 25 years. They're not putting enough aside. So the average association, according to this study, is only 51% funded of not what it will need eventually, but what it needs right now in its bank account in order to have enough money when the time comes to put on their roof. And again, that's just the known stuff. We're finding out with the typical wood frame, low-rise condominium structure that there is a great deal of damage going on that no one knows about because it's under the surface. And and there's no reserve for that, none at all. And what happens when that's discovered, where do you get the money? You have to go to the members, ask for a special assessment, which can be tens of thousands of dollars on people who can't afford it, or you go for a bank loan, and then you have to raise your assessments, monthly assessments, to amortize the bank loan. So we have underfunding of reserves for known problems, and we have no funding for unknown problems.
So the only solution is to raise, from what I'm understanding from what you're saying, the only solution is to raise assessments.
Well,
is there another way of doing
it? Well, there's a couple of solutions.
Okay.
One is to gain a better knowledge, to gain more information on the condition of your building so you can address some of these problems very early in their life at a very inexpensive price rather than waiting 15 or 20 years when catastrophe occurs, either a life safety issue or a huge funding problem. So inspections that do more than what the statute now requires and what this bill would have required condos to do, but they were left out of it, would have probed the interiors of these buildings in a way that would have alerted these boards of directors and these managers to a problem that could be serious if it's not addressed right now. It's kind of like early detection of cancer. If you detect some of it early, you might be able to cure it. If you wait till you don't detect it till much later, it may be too late. And early detection would protect these associations financially if they were to do it. They're not doing it, and that's why they're catching these huge assessments later on. But there's no avoiding the cost of living unless you do it artificially by ignoring it. Raising assessments to keep up with inflation would seem to be a logical thing to do. A lot of associations don't do it just to keep up with inflation, but also to fully fund your reserves so that you have enough money down the road to fix those long-term issues that you know about would also be something that you could do gradually and spread the cost of that over all of the succession of owners who come in to the project, one after the other. You spread that across, say, 20 years of owners instead of dumping it on the owners who happen to be unlucky enough to be there when that problem is discovered. And meanwhile, all those prior owners have escaped that responsibility. So if you were to adequately assess, meaning recognize inflation, fully fund reserves, and inspect so that you detect these hidden conditions early, now you're recognizing the true cost of ownership. Otherwise, you're hiding from it. You're not, the owners who live there aren't paying the true cost of owning that condo. They're paying something artificially low, and they're passing the liability for the deferred maintenance on to owners who come later. And I don't believe that's fair.
No, I agree with you, but as you mentioned earlier, I think it's a problem with the entire model that we're dealing with, the condo model. But
here's the problem with, and I agree with you, I think the model's flawed. I've said it and written about it many times.
Yeah, you and I are really on the same wavelength on this at all. We are. I mean,
the answer to that is you have mandatory assessments determined by a uninterested third party who doesn't own a unit, who doesn't pay those assessments, and who makes a professional judgment as to what the true cost of ownership is and assesses and sets assessments accordingly. That, of course, raises the spectrum of big government intruding on individual ownership rights. And so there we have another conflict. If the solution is a third party, some sort of trustee or something like that, setting these assessments or doing it by statute, you have the government quote, interfering, unquote, with the rights of the owners. And those were some of the issues raised by individual owners when they would call their legislators and argue that condos should not be required to do these safety inspections.
That's something that they were probably coached by their association attorneys, because I tell you what, most of these homeowners don't think that way. I can guarantee you, the board
not by this association attorney.
I really appreciate that, because it's always good to talk to you, because although we may be on different ends of this whole thing, there's so much in the middle that you and I really agree on, and we're singing from the same sheet of music. So it's nice to be able to discuss that without closing your mind and saying, she just doesn't like associations, so she has nothing of value to contribute. And that's, you know, I run into that quite a bit. So I appreciate having you on, and I thank you for sending me all this stuff, because I've learned a ton of stuff from you. But one thing that occurs to me as well is that everything that we're talking about seems to be post-construction. We talk about government interference. I don't like the government interfering, but, you know, the local municipal government charges us tons of taxes and does nothing for those tax dollars. The least thing they could do is have inspectors out to make sure that things are done properly. I've seen pictures of these balconies that have collapsed that are not even connected to the frame of the house. They're just sort of hanging there.
Well, see, that's, of course, would raise a topic you and I could spend another hour on at some other point. But
oh, we can't do it today? No, I'm kidding.
The community association concept model is of great value to municipalities for the simple reason that it has allowed them to pass the maintenance of an awful lot of components on to the individual owners that otherwise would have been the city's responsibility, yet they collect property taxes that would have otherwise paid for those things. Now they can use them for other things.
Yeah.
And it is municipalities are complicit in some of this, both because they don't adequately inspect the buildings. They leave code compliance up to the contractor for the most part. And I will say that building, that balcony that collapsed in Berkeley and killed those poor students, was inspected two or three times by both the municipality and the contractor. The reason that they didn't know is because it was enclosed. It was concealed damage.
So this was post-construction. Yeah, this was post-construction.
That's right.
Okay.
So, yes, municipalities could help, but see, their argument's going to be, well, we can't afford that level of inspection, so we're going to want that done privately.
They rely
on private inspectors.
That's unacceptable. That's so totally unacceptable. If I needed to put in a new dishwasher, I have to go and pay the county for a permit, and they have nothing to do with it. They have absolutely nothing to do with it. The guy who sells it brings me the dishwasher, hooks it up, and away we go.
Yeah.
But catastrophic
failures are only a small part of the problem. The bigger problem, from a dollar standpoint, probably in billions of dollars, is the amount of underfunded deferred maintenance that is gathering in these projects over time that somebody down the road is going to have to pay for.
Yeah.
And if they can't pay for it, then the project is probably going to become obsolete. It cannot continue to function. And everyone who has equity in that project then will lose it, because the project will fail. These balconies or stairways won't be able to be fixed, and the cities will come in and condemn them. We've seen two or three projects already that were under condemnation. Fortunately, they were able to, by one way or another, raise several millions of dollars in order to do the repairs, but the owners were saddled with monster assessments in order to do it. The only reason that they were that succeeded is the projects were pretty well located in high-end areas that where the prices were going up, so the owners were willing to pay it. But if you're looking at low-income housing, low-income people in housing that is not particularly in desirable areas, and you have a problem like this, they're not going to be able to do anything about it, and they're going to ultimately lose their investment in that property.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're absolutely correct that that happens.
Yep. In fact, I'm looking at, later today, I'm looking at a project here in, close to my office, a large condo project. It's fairly well maintained. It's well managed. But the owners realize that it's becoming, it's getting to the point where it's losing value because of its age and its the amenities. And they're actually looking to perhaps redevelop it into something else. And we're going to take a nonprofit entity over there to look at it, maybe convert it into affordable housing. Don't know that, but it's a whole area of our practice that's beginning to evolve. Is what do we do with these when they fail down the road? Problem is, you don't often get the opportunity to save them while the owner's equity can be preserved. Often you only see them after it's too late. And most of the equity is gone because the project has so much deferred maintenance built up in it.
When you say you're going to turn it into affordable housing, I sit here and I wonder, how can you turn something like this into affordable housing? It's unaffordable. It's not working. The only way people can afford them is if they're very, very wealthy and they're in upscale, high-end housing. But when you put people who can barely scrape together enough money to go from paycheck to paycheck, and then you make them responsible for maintaining streets, sewer, discovering hidden maintenance issues coming, it doesn't make sense. To me, it doesn't.
Well, I'm going to say something that won't be very popular because it'll sound almost un-American, but there is a lower limit to what is affordable owned housing. And below that, you have to look at rental housing, where an investor group is required to maintain it, maintain all those things, and set rents at a level that owners can afford.
Yeah.
One of the problems that we had that led to the big recession back in 08 was we made this decision that virtually anybody should be able to own a house.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to make loans to people who really couldn't afford them, couldn't afford to amortize them. And so what we got was massive foreclosures, massive defaults. And the fact was, we have to recognize that at some income level, owned housing isn't practical. And you have to look at providing affordable housing that's actually rental housing, where someone with the capital to deal with, maintain it properly and safely, is the owner. And that's not a popular position to take, but it's a realistic one. When you look at the demographics of a lot of the owners in a lot of these older condos, especially seniors who are living on fixed incomes and simply cannot afford the increasing assessments that are necessary to maintain their ownership. And it's a very, very hard position for us to be in because we sympathize with these folks. And we don't want, people want to be able to stay in their homes. And they want to be able to retire there and they want to be able to live out their life in their homes. But it's often that desire often comes in conflict with the cost of living in those places.
Yeah.
And I think we're not being as realistic as we need to be about understanding that.
I think we need to start looking at this and learning these lessons before we keep building them. I know Habitat for Humanity has gone into, or they had at one point gone into, building developments, association housing, and giving them to people who cannot afford them, and then making them responsible for not just their house, but for the entire surrounding area. Now you've got people who are incapable of earning the money and planning on buying a house, putting up the money and all of that. Now they've got to come up with maintaining roads and sewers and infrastructure and all of that, and it's way beyond their capability.
Well, actually, I'm very interested in working with some of those nonprofits to see what we can do with some of these obsolete condominium associations to convert them into affordable housing with the help of one of these nonprofits. That may be one of the avenues to gaining true affordability and also to resurrect the, you know, this housing as it that's failing because it can't be maintained by the existing owners.
That's something I really hope that you will keep me posted on. It's something that I'm interested in. I used to sell.
Yeah.
I used to sell real estate, and it was push, push, push. You had to, you know, everybody had, and it was during the time before the whole bubble burst. But yeah, it was like everybody deserved it. We had all these finance programs to help people get into housing. We're going to help you buy a house, make you a homeowner. That's the American dream. You deserve it. And there were all these low cost insurance or mortgages sponsored by the government.
But in here where I live, Northern California is the poster child for unaffordable housing. Prices are pricing the working class people out of, not only out of their houses, but out of the area. People are commuting 30, 40 miles, 50 miles from the Central Valley just to get to jobs that don't pay them enough to afford anything closer in. And the toll on their families and their personal lives is incalculable.
Yeah.
And because we don't have any affordable close-in housing. And one of the possibilities is, if I'm right about the trajectory, the life trajectory of some of these condominium associations as being one that will eventually have an end to it because they can't afford to maintain it as such, that we take those and use perhaps the resources of these nonprofits to create truly affordable housing in a closer in area for these working class folks who are absolutely essential to maintaining our economy.
What about these houses, buildings that you're talking about that might have some serious damage, construction defects and damage within it because they weren't built properly, because they're failing, because they're rotting, whether it was the bad material or whether it was because they didn't seal them properly?
Well, one of the things we're looking at is what do you do with them? And there's a whole range of possibilities depending on their condition. Everything from rehabilitating or reconstructing what's already there and putting some nonprofit capital into it and rebuilding it into affordable housing, or simply leveling it and building something new there that is perhaps higher density and brings more people into it than you could have done, say, 30, 40 years ago under the zoning that existed at that time. Now, a lot of these projects have been in areas that are now more urbanized, and the zoning has changed, allowing perhaps a more dense populated project to be built, and that may provide the incentive for a profit or a nonprofit developer to come in and take over the project and build something there that will accommodate more people and provide more affordable housing in those areas.
You know, the studio is in a place. The Washington Post did an article on my show back in 2001, I think it was, and they described this as a seedy industrial area. And it was. It was a really seedy industrial area. But they've torn that all apart, and they've built what is now known as the Mosaic District with a lot of, you know, it's all this walkable community. You walk to restaurants and shops, and all the high-end shops are moving in, and they've got apartments, and they've got condos, and they've got townhouses, and it's increased density, and, you know, there's a, they don't want cars, and they want, you know, these flex cars and all of that. But the thing is, it's still unaffordable. The people who work in this building cannot afford to live in this area and walk to work.
Yeah, a lot of this redevelopment that we're seeing in those former industrial areas like you're talking about ends up with very high-end projects.
Right.
We live across the bay from San Francisco, and we're watching what's happening in a lot of the formerly industrial areas, South Market and other places like that. And what's going in there are very, very expensive condominiums, not necessarily for San Francisco, but certainly for the region. And what I'm hoping to be able to do, if we succeed, is take some of these old condo projects that are in these close-in areas, and instead of putting high-end projects there, maybe putting in, using those and putting in, making them into affordable housing. But it's going to take some capital investment by somebody, and a developer won't do it unless there's a profit in it. And I understand that completely. Of course it wouldn't be. But it's possible that a nonprofit like Habitat for Humanity, perhaps, could get involved with that. And the inventory that's out there that could be susceptible to this is pretty extensive. But nobody thinks in terms of taking a condo project and turning it into something else, because they think that's what it has to be for the rest of its life. But not necessarily. It can be redeveloped just like anything else.
There's a lot of talk about terminations, where they're taking these condominiums and terminating them, and some of the owners are getting caught in. They don't want to lose their units. You find that you have some people, board members. I mean, I've been contacted by a number of homeowners who say there's nothing wrong with the building, yet the board members want to sell it because they're going to profit by it, and you're shutting out some of the people. So it's a big problem, Tyler.
Well, there are two ways that works. You take old apartment houses and you convert them into condos, and you throw out all the tenants and you begin selling them as condos. So that's kind of another kind of termination, condo conversions. And I completely disagree with the concept, because you take an old building that's already a problem from a construction standpoint, you sell it to people who then are responsible for all of that. But then the other way is what you were just talking about, taking a condo, terminating the condo plan, and rebuilding it into something else that you can charge more money for. What I'm looking at is those projects that simply cannot be maintained habitable. You cannot maintain the habitability of them safely with the amount of money that the owners are willing to put into it, where you have rot, or you have deterioration of the foundations, or you have soil issues, or you have things that have accumulated over time that make the project eventually uninhabitable. And why do I say that? Because the city wants to come in and they want to put tags on the doors and basically condemn the building. Those are the kinds that I'm talking about. So it's not a question of a for-profit developer coming in and kicking out a lot of low-income people like you hear about, and I think that's what you were talking about. We're talking about projects that cannot be maintained any longer in the condition that they're in a safe and habitable state.
There's so many issues and so many problems, and I think you've taken up a big chunk of some of the problems. I'm really curious. I would love to continue covering all this, because I think it's absolutely fascinating. I'd love to know how this is all going to end.
Yeah, we're all kind of looking at the same thing, and I guess it's why I don't spend a lot of time with the small behavioral issues and other kinds of topics that come up in this never-ending argument between condo boards and individual owners, because I'm looking at what's the real question.
Yeah.
What's the sustainability of this project?
Right.
Well, who cares about your potted plants if the balcony is going to fall off?
That you makes know, sense.
That's why what you get from me is I kind of step back and I'm looking at a much more critical issue, and I don't have, even though we see it all the time in our firm, this happens a lot. I don't get involved in that because, frankly, to me, that's not what's important. What's important is what are you going to be able to protect these owners, the safety of the occupants, and protect their equity over the long term or not? And that's what you need to be looking at in putting your energy into, as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, the other stuff happens, too, and people have their own feelings about it. And in the meanwhile, there's thousands and thousands of these that will last for a long time, and will have these problems for a long time.
Well, based on what you're saying, I don't know how long they're going to last if they all start collapsing and crumbling to bits. But before I let you go, I have a very quick question. How do you suppose the legislators can exempt condominiums from this legislation when it deals with the safety? I mean, we're not talking about this is, you know, something that we want. It's not a fantasy. It's actual safety.
Because legislators are, like any other politician, they are influenced by their constituents. And when you can rally a whole group of owners, including a lot of senior citizens who live on fixed incomes, to get on a phone bank and call the legislator and say, you have to vote no on this safety bill because it'll cost too much money and I can't afford the assessments now, and that will raise my assessments and I won't be able to afford to live there, and I'm a senior citizen. That's how.
That makes perfectly good sense, but you're still dealing with people's safety.
Still dealing with what? I'm
people,
sorry.
People's safety. I mean, senior citizens can go out on a balcony,
yes,
that's going to collapse.
That's right. Right. So really the question, and you'll see it in this. I think I sent you the material.
No, I just got. But would you send it?
Oh, sure. I'll be happy to.
Thanks.
The last question I ask is an association's maintenance and repair obligation to be decided solely by what the present owners are willing to pay? Of course not. Because if you do that, you'll never fix anything because they're not willing to pay enough to maintain it now. That's the problem. You can't put the maintenance of the decisions regarding the maintenance of something as important as a big structure like that and make that dependent on a voluntary decision by owners as to what they want to pay. And when an owner's get on the phone, call their legislators and say, I can't afford my assessments, I don't want them to go any higher, vote no on the bill. Then that's what you're doing. The legislators are simply following the demands of the present owners at the expense of the long-term interests of that corporation.
I think education has got to be a big part of it, and you're doing that with your seminar, and I would love to see that expanded to more people. They may not agree with you, but they have to understand what's entailed.
Yeah, they do, and most don't, because there's so much turnover in these projects that what education I provide tomorrow or the next day will be unknown to the people that move in there the day after.
That's why I say you want to go to the housing consumers, the people who are not owners now but who will be owners, and maybe at some point they're going to say, wait a minute, you know, they're going to start asking questions.
Maybe. And we're looking for every avenue we can find to acquaint people with the true cost of owning a common interest in a common interest development. But, you know, we're not assisted very well by a lot of the people that live there now. They don't listen to
a lot of them listen to my show, so we can do it on this show.
Okay.
Tyler, thank you so much. I know you have something else coming up, and I appreciate you taking the time to discuss this with us.
It's always fun. Thank you very much, Sue.
Thanks, Tyler. Thanks to all.
Bye now.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.